gone for 2 days. Come back last night, I was looking, I read the headline, and then I quickly scanned and I thought my name was going to be there. And I looked, I saw Matthew last word, and I said, whoops, it's not me, it's you.
In these songbooks that you've got, you'll find Steady War No More. You all know it anyway. Would you go get them from people that are sitting in the Claire, we'll go pick up a couple from the crowd where they
here, take this one.
Everybody found it? Wave your songbook if you found it. Okay, there's enough there for a quorum. Catherine, will you start us off with an introduction?
Thank you.
working class. Because they're quite a project and an expense to make and put together. We're hoping to use them for a long time at gatherings like this. And I think you agree that they're a good idea and that they certainly make it easy to get everybody singing. So will you please turn them back? In fact, just as soon as we finish singing, I'm going to ask our two members who gave them out to come around and just take them away from you. And don't pull them up and put them in your pocket, because you'll feel guilty about it. We are so sold on the idea that we want to invite right now all the men in the audience to join. We want to have you all members. Seriously, if there's anybody in this crowd, which we certainly hope that would like to...
together we'll be heard. testimonial to the personality like Pat Gleason, who has all his life never had more than one allegiance and one loyalty, and that is to the people. He's a man that is tireless, has been tireless for years in his efforts. He's always been able to gumshoe around to every door and back alley to peddle the political propaganda of the progressive movement. And so I think that we, and especially myself, feel deeply moved and highly honored in the privilege to give a testimonial to a great personality that has done more than many people for the working class, the farmer, and everybody. Thank you, Pat.
With all of you tonight, in honor of Mr. Patrick J. Gleason. You people gathered here are lucky. We've never had the pleasure of meeting Pat Gleason or shaking his hand, but we feel we know him and appreciate him with you. He has helped the Guardian grow and raise its lusty voice for peace and progress. Pat Gleason, we salute you on your 74th birthday. May you have many more years of fruitful life and good work. And personally, Pat, I wish you the same thing and more.
I have known Pat a long time. And the thing I want to say about Pat is that he knows better, he makes us understand better than anything else how you have to exercise the right of free speech. And he's been around exercising it for a good many years now. And I'd hate to be the one to try to stop him. And, you know, the Constitution is something like, in some ways, it's something like a union contract. It's the words are nice, but you have to have some good shop stewards around in order to see to it that it's enforced. And I think that in Pat we have a very good watchdog of the Constitution, and in doing that, well, he certainly has worked for all of us, and I'm sure that we all of us appreciate the wonderful things that he has done over the years. So I wish him a happy birthday and well, say 20-30 more of
them. And Pat, it's been a privilege and a pleasure to work with Pat through the years. And I think there's one lesson he taught me, I think he's taught all of us. Whenever there was an issue involving the rights of the people, Pat took that issue where it rightly belonged to the people. And I think that's a lesson that all of us can stand. And I wish Pat many, many more happy birthdays. Best of luck.
This almost moves me to tears. To think of the great honor that you have bestowed on me on a night like this, when we are gathered to honor our honored guests. I met Pat a long time ago. It doesn't seem so long, but it was a long time ago. It was in my first campaign in 1922, when I went out as the only woman candidate for that revolutionary program of the newly born Farmer Labor Party. I met him at Olivia at a meeting. And I was introduced to him as the editor of the Bendel County Journal. I'd always had great respect for editors. until I found out really what editors could do. Until I found an editor that admitted, I haven't written a word that I really believe for 20 years. Pat was not that kind of an editor. He enlisted in the editorial ranks with a free will, with an earnest desire to fight for the better things. He wouldn't have had to do it. I think he could have found some other kind of a job that would perhaps have been more lucrative. He told me that he took over the Bendel County Journal when it carried a debt of $30,000. And Pat was only a little man. And so it's a wonder to me, even though I did a similar job down in Goodyear County, it's a wonder to me how Pat really could decide to take up that blazing torch and blaze a path of truth and light for the farmer and the worker. The farmer who was being forced away from his homes by foreclosure, and the worker who was unemployed and in poverty. Pat could have said he could play safe. He could have chosen the middle of the road, Pat, and he could have talked from both sides of his face. You know, there's some people that do that. They do it at one and the same time. But that was not Pat. He must have heard somewhere that he who saves his life shall lose it. And so he preferred to save his life by helping to save the farmers from foreclosure and the workers from unemployment and poverty. And down through the years, as you all know, Pat has been faithful to this vision of service. He's always stood like the good soldier who said, "It's great to be out where the fight is strong, to be where the heaviest troops belong, and to fight there for man and God." And that is where Pat still stands. And with his last breath, he'll be standing there. I've been sitting under the current Lenten services, and I thought much about our parallel Calvary Road, for we're still crucifying the Prince of Peace and all those who truly own his spirit to the point of carrying the cross of vilification and abuse for it. We're still crucifying the Prince of Peace. And once again, the poet could write, "Right forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne." And yet there's a beautiful sequel to it when we read that God is somewhere in the shadows keeping watch above his own. The stage of the world today, of the world action today, we can't touch that tonight. That's too long a story. But I thought it was pretty significant last night when Edward R. Murrow was reporting. And he quoted Mark Twain. He quoted Mark Twain as saying in his humorous vein, "If only every nation had 5 million soldiers, how happy and secure we all would feel." I said to myself, what a picture of Harold Stassen as assistant to the president on disarmament. You know, some of us feel that, as I did when I raised my 5 boys, that when they picked up sticks and stones, the first thing I did was to disarm them. After all, for every country to arm 5 million soldiers, some of us do not consider the best guarantee for peace. It's really a laugh. You know, I was reading a volume of the 100 best poems the other day. And when I saw this poem, "Abraham Lincoln Walks at Midnight," By Vachel Lindsay, I thought of Cats. It's so marvelous. It reads, I'll just read you a stanza. His head is bowed. He thinks on men and kings. Yea, when the sick world cries, how can he sleep? Too many peasants fight, they know not why. Too many homesteads in black terror lie. The sins of all the warlords burn his heart. He sees the dreadnoughts scouring every main. He carries on his shawled, racked shoulders now the bitterness, the folly, and the pain. He cannot rest until a spirit dawn shall come, the shining hope of Europe free, the league of sober folk, the workers' earth, bringing long peace to cornland, Alp, and sea. And I think that's the vision that that Pat has seen. I think that has been the crux of his whole activity, a world free and at peace. And because Pat is an Irishman, and I'm a good Norwegian, I thought I'd sing him an Irish song tonight. I happen to be very fond of Irish songs, and I'm going to try to sing Galway Bay.
They scorned us just for being. most of the years of 1917 on, and had to go on a snowstorm meeting out in the country to hear A.C. Townley on a nonpartisan league. They forbid the farmers having a hall in town. So we went 2 miles east of Franklin, and the farmer pulled the machinery out to get the women inside, and the rest just stood out in the snowstorm and heard Townley give his speech. Well, that was the beginning of warfare in the nonpartisan league. It's gone on right to the present time. And I want to say something about that particular meeting. The farmers in our area, especially where I was in a German community, but one third Irish. But we decided to go to see about getting an organization like the Equity. But we heard about the Nonpartisan League in North Dakota. So the German says, well, we may wait till the Nonpartisan League comes, maybe that'll be more effective. Well, that snowstorm meeting, the Townley really made history. How he capitalized on that. He says, now, you farmers come out here, hard-working farmers, the first time you ever asked for a hall, you didn't get it. He says, I can tell that you worked hard. You can tell by the wrinkles on your forehead and your roughness of your hands. You worked all your days to help these people to make an easy living. But he says, maybe you're to blame yourself. Now he says, for instance, maybe you have spoiled those people, those businessmen uptown. Now he says, get this little girl here and get up on the table and I'll explain. He says, now this 4-year-old girl, if you don't kind of discipline her a little bit and let her do what she like, you know what she'll do? She'll probably get one hand in the butter, the other in the sugar pole, and make a mess of things. But he says, that's what you've done with these people uptown. You made them think that they were the real kings, and you spoiled them. Now he says, you go uptown, don't call them down, just treat them nice, and they'll get ashamed of themselves. And you ought to see the number of farmers went up and put down their $16 a piece and joined up the Nonpartisan League. Well, then from then on, we had Lindbergh, who was candidate for governor, and that made history. Because Colonel Lindbergh took a stand against the war that he didn't think that we should have got into that war. Well, I happened to be in a German community, and they didn't think so. But lo and behold, the Irish in my neighborhood, they thought it was all right. And I was just misled by being up in that German community. I said, oh no, I think they know more about this whole situation. Well, they began to class this as disloyal. That became the issue. Loyalty is the issue. And that went over the whole state. So we were condemned as disloyal. And my Irish friends down in the neighborhood, he says, well, you better break loose from them. I says, they're right. And you people are wrong. Well, it'll catch your whole township off and mark you disloyal. And it'll be putting you right in the front line trenches. Well, I says, I've told that to some of our people. I says, well, they need good men over there. But how about you fellows so loyal? You ought to be the ones going in. But I said, I happen to see one of you people down there. Got 3 sons and the father, and not one of them in the army. Now, you better not tell us what we must do. Well, that was the beginning of the Nonpartisan League. The women didn't vote that time. But lo and behold, Lindbergh got 150,000 votes. They began to respect him. Didn't think Minnesota would do that. Well, I went down to my city, and after that I went to my cousins down there. He said, what's the matter with you fellas out there? Well, I said, the farmer's got a complaint to make. Cost of production, they're not getting it. Well, he says, down here we call it the Don Peterson League because there's so many Scandinavians in it. Well, I said, that's all right. I'm with them. I said, maybe the Scandinavians know a hell of a lot more about what war is because Norway and Sweden haven't had a war in 125 years. They learned what to go do without war. Well, that honor developed into, we'll skip a few years then, and we go to the 1920s. And the cry was around in my neighborhood, well, these Germans aren't kicking in. I says, wait a while, about buying Liberty Bonds and all that. I says, after they had the second drive for bonds, they put over a war saving stamp drive and made me chairman of it. And I says, where we were assessed for $12,000, I bring into the courthouse $13,500. Every German in there and everyone in the whole township have subscribed. So he says, don't call us disloyal. Well, this Lindbergh parade is going to go through this county seat town, and if they behave themselves. I says, when we deliver things like that, but I says, what do you fellows know about the farming conditions? You have wheat going right up the edge of town and corn, but you are not out work producing it. You think you know, but you don't. And I quoted them, and I went on to say that our township has turned out what you called us disloyal. Well, like hell, is that right? I said, yes. We turned over $13,500. Well, I said, I've got to go home now. I got to drive home and produce food for the war. Never mind, you're doing good work here. Now, that's a Republican town. So you see that they begin to wake up to a situation. But they didn't stop there. We had our town meeting, Farmers Club. I think I have the button here yet, the Norfolk Farmers Club. And by the way, I have an old people's party button here. It goes back to 1893. Populist Party. I don't think there's another one in the state. At least I inquired. And my father joined the Populist Party back in 1893. I'll go over these now before I go on with it a little further. Well, I've got all these buttons. Floyd Olson, 4 times campaigned for Roosevelt. Farm labor button, Benson button. And when they said the non-partial league was dead in our county, that was after I managed the paper, we made up our mind that it wasn't dead. So we organized Renville County and got 500 signers and made a Renville County non-partial league. Made a button. Well, later years in the Fourth Ward, here comes a man who joined the Farm Labor Association. And he says, my father was a Republican. He says, I've got a button that he had of Benjamin Harrison, 1889. He says, now that I'm no longer a Republican, I'll make a donation to you. So there's the button, Benjamin Harrison. Well, now, in regard to the farmers, we had a chairman who was a German, and he was greatly upset over this war. His boy was drafted. But here comes the people come out from town to advise us. And they said, well, I asked for if they had a loyalty, if they had a wonder for bonds and all that, send a speaker out. So they sent a lawyer out to tell us, practically, about the old German alliance and condemned the whole situation that we farmers were wrong going this non-partisan league and gave us a regular lecture. Well, Mr. Olson, who had never gone beyond the 7th or 8th grade, he said, no, attorney, I won't mention his name. He says, how is it, is everything going all right at the courthouse in Olivia? He says, you know, we understand the treasurer is $2,000 short. Now you come out and lecture to us, we got something to tell you fellas. Well, so he says, we have to admit it, that has happened. Did they stop then? They sent another lecture out. And he's supposed to be, went to Europe and studied wheat. And now the grades of wheat, where we had our greatest complaint. In Kansas City, the price of wheat went to something like $3 a bushel. But by the time they got to Minnesota, they put a set price on it, $2.26. But at the same time, they overthrew the federal grains, the Minnesota grains, and put over federal grains, the doctor's three grades, So it brought our prices down to about $1.80. That was the complaint that we made, and that the North Dakota farmers made, and what started the whole idea of building a state-owned mill and an elevator so they don't have to ship their grain, pay the freight, and let the gamblers go on it, and then pay the freight back and pay both ways. They put it on their own state-owned mill. That was the beginning of their socialism in North Dakota. They went further. They put in a bank. Well, that was awful. Put in a bank. Well, later I found this. We had a case of coming out for a bank guarantee when I was managing a paper. One of the ones at Sacred Heart. Well, we put our hand out. I said, go ahead. We're still going to go out for bank guarantee law. So we get into all kinds of these things. Well, the man that came out on the wheat grades, we lectured him. He'd better raise some wheat so he'd know what he's talking about. So those are some of the things. But then comes along, when the boys come back from the war, what they won't do. When the boys came back, we found that they went down our alley. And among the ones noted for that was George Mellon of Minneapolis, one of Pershing's picked 100 heroes. And he came back, he says, we went over there, risked our lives for $1 a day. We come back to Minnesota and found a free speech while we were away fighting. Well, I heard George Mellon afterward at a national convention in St. Louis. When a committee of 48, they wanted to get a third party, and they met in the Stanford Hotel in St. Louis. Well, I had to get down there a little bit late, but we found what happened. And this committee of 48 were liberal Republicans and Democrats, nonpartisan leagues and socialists, and I don't know what others, everything was there, I guess. But a Kansas City Legion boys telephoned the manager, don't turn this assembly hall over, because this is a bunch of socialists. Well, the mayor of St. Louis began to find out what's happening, that these are liberal people from all over the country. Malone, a rich man from New York, and Alexander, Miss Alexander, I think a congresswoman from Montana. And so the mayor calls up, says, well, you can have the courthouse. Well, I came in when they announced that, and one mighty cheer went up. But where did we assemble when we couldn't go up on the 12th floor of the big assembly hall? Well, two of us that are kind of extra-radical from Olivia had a people's voice. And we brought a lot of literature because we were boosting Governor Fraser, maybe be a good man for president. And so we had, on the second floor, two little rooms with all our literature in there. So they couldn't kick us out of there. Well, all these delegates went along down the hall, and when they heard the mayor of St. Louis offer the courthouse, one mighty cheer went up. And another thing happened. The socialist mayor of Milwaukee found out about what's happening, that we're standing our grounds. He sent us a telegram, congratulations that you're standing for free speech, more power to you. Well, the next thing happened. The owners of the Stafford Hotel in New York, he heard of what's happening. He telephoned his manager, give the keys to the committee of 48, let them do what the damn please. Well, the Legion boys in Kansas City found they got in bad, and they telephoned in, begging pardon that they misunderstood the thing and asked forgiveness. Well, that afternoon, all you heard for the whole afternoon, free speech, free assembly. And George Mellon from Minneapolis, he still had his uniform on, he told the same story, that went over there and fought for liberty, here we come back, we don't have free speech. It's pretty near time that we have real democracy. Well, that's all they heard then for the 3 days of the convention. Well, they didn't come to any decision of who they might nominate for president on a third party ticket, but they had socialists there, single taxers, I don't know how many more different kinds of organizations. But afterwards, they were to meet in Chicago to finish the job. Well, the mayor of Rochester, Minnesota, who was a farmer labor mayor then of Rochester, he went to the one in Chicago. And I asked him how they come out there. But he says, I think there's more radical yet, and was in St. Louis. So he said, I think they had a bomb there. I even think they had some bomb throwers. I don't know. But anyway, Pauli Christensen was the man that they nominated and made the race a third-party ticket. Well, that's giving the high points. But in my own area, we had such a man as Tommy Sullivan, who was a secretary under Lindbergh as a congressman. And so he was out on this grain situation and telling about the robbery of the farmers to the set price on grain. And he also mentioned on livestock. He said, now, for instance, Usher Burdick, who is a well-known farmer who has a couple of farms in North Dakota, and Usher Burdick always sent his livestock down to one commission farm in South St. Paul. But this particular carload he shipped down that he had branded, they had paid him only 6 cents for his cattle. He thought, my gosh, he says, there's something wrong. 3 or 4 years raising these here and all I get is 6 cents? That's all he could give. His old farm that he had traded with. So he said he thought he'd watch those cattle to see what had become of them. And Tommy Sullivan tells this out through our country. Now Tommy was an Irish Catholic who got in a little bit wrong because he was taking such a radical stand. All right, but he and I got along pretty good. So anyway, Burdick followed those cattle. One commission farm sold it to another. That one sold it to another. And that one sold to a farmer for 9 cents. So he got a few exchanges. They got half as much as he did 3 or 4 years raising those cattle. Usher Burdick became pretty interested in nonpartisan league then. He wasn't when he was a kind of middle-class man. He's still congressman from North Dakota, Usher Burdick. He learned his lesson the hard way. We had farmers in our county who were speculative farmers. An attorney, he had 11 farms. So he used to argue with me across the table. But when the hard times came and he began to lose the farms, all at once he became progressive. We had Murphy from Wheaton, who also had a number of farms. So he became converted and began to lose them. Where did I see Frank Murphy? When I was down in Iowa, just before the Hoover election, Frank Murphy was down there talking for Al Smith, the Farmers Union. So you see, an attorney comes quite a long ways. But anyway, I was writing insurance and getting a little bit more money than I did in North Dakota, where they were hard up. And I went on to Montana, and they were not much money, so I went down to Iowa thinking by writing insurance I could get a better income. So I had a couple of farmers joining, helping me go from one farm to another. But the next day after Hoover was elected, these people said, well, maybe we're mistaken after all. Maybe it's a bigger man than we thought. So that's what they had to do, and put me out of business. Well, then, caught down in another state, I had to find myself to get a job on a farm. And I wound up on a farm, and the fellow came to the hotel, says, well, you're pretty light for farm work. Haven't you been farming? I said, not for 5 or 6 years. Well, he said, I don't know, there's 15 others called up for that job. That's just what happened to Hoover got elected. But he said, no, you were first, you can come out. We'll try you out. But he says, I want to know that the 1st of March, you got to be $40 a month. I said, no, $50. I know what the work is, 16 hours a day. Well, come on out. Well, the 1st of March came, he still stuck $40 a month. I said, no, it's going to be $50 in board and room. All right, he set the alarm for me. Then I learned the hard way. After spending a lot of money and time in the nonpartisan league and got away in debt. So he set the alarm for me to get up that we might get going for the 1st of March. Time, 4:30. From that till about 9 o'clock at night. So I hired out for 8 months. At the end of 8 months, he was a hard-working German. He got extra 80 acres of land, got away in debt. But at the end of the 8 months, they hired me for another year. Well, a funeral happened. I happened to drift back to Minneapolis, where I got in touch with my cousin Leo Gleason. As long as I make such a big story about Gleason. By the way, this pin here, button. Yeah, no, that's all right. You'll keep the button. The non-partisan, the People's Party button. On the back of it, you'll find manufactured by Thomas J. Gleason, New York. Manufacture that button in 1893. And it comes to the story of when I came down to Minneapolis, they jumped on me. Well, they all belong to that non-partisan Peterson League up there. There's my cousin Leo Gleason, by the way. Well, I said, sure. I'm interested. The we farmers got a complaint to make. Well, the next day I had a call to his office to come down, Johnny Callahan, Johnny Leo. He says, you know why I'm interested? I said, I don't know. I want to run for the legislature. But he says, doggone, people over there, they all got along with the Tawny movement. How can I go along with it? Well, I said, you better go along with the Tawny movement. You better stick with the labor if you want to get elected. So he took the advice and he got elected. So Leo goes over and he gets to the legislature. So the first thing you know, he gets to fart around with the Republican Nolan, Speaker of the House. The next election, he left at home because he can't go along with the Republican and play the farm labor game. The Polish people, these others, forgot to put him in again. Well, Leo had to find himself an assistant county attorney down here to influence Floyd Olson. But by the way, when the Farm Labor Party got pretty popular, they wrote to them down here to see if they can get Floyd Olson from the Democratic Party into the Farm Labor Party. So they suggested and want to know about the $1 million ditches and drainage. So I sent them some literature and trained them on that. So by the way, in 1924, we had all eight candidates to running for the Farm Labor Party came to Olivia, and I was to the chairman to introduce them in the park because we had a strong organization there that had that whole 7th district. So Judge Baker's wife says, don't vote Floyd Olson in to the last because we were supporting Tom Davis here. But by my connection with Floyd Olson, I won him in second place. But he gave such a powerful speech, he almost won over the Tom Davis setup. But I want to tell you about that. From then on, Floyd went right along. But he was defeated in the fall election. He won the primaries, 1924. But I want to tell you about the 7th district, which Dolly Burke knows about. She had a campaign for Reverend Qualley, first congressman elected on the farm labor ticket. Reverend Qualley. She campaigned through there, so did I. Well, we elected them. And Shipstead was elected. But our paper folded up the next week, then before I took over, because they held and put money into it till the election was over. Next week it folded, ready to fold up. But the 7th Congressional District, I want to explain that. We won, I guess, here four times. Always went farm labor. But then the Republican legislature began to what they call a gerrymander. They took Magnus Johnson's county and took it away and put in an extra county as long as the Republicans were strong. Well, they gerrymandered that, so the 7th district today comes way around over to the south line and clear down the Iowa line. They're gerrymandered 19 counties, so to make it forever after Republican. So that's why Jim J. Lungdale has a heck of a time to get anywhere because of that situation. But, so coming back to the situation on the Magnus Johnson, they begin to get the people, well, this non-partisan league, that's too radical. We got to get it a little bit different. And Magnus began to go along with that. And he began to go to the Chautauqua meetings, the bankers' club, instead of staying around among the farmers. And when we were publishing the Minnesota Leader, we had to see if we could do something in Magnus going along with these people and want to show the newspaper to one side. It's too radical. So anyway, this printer who had to show me how to get along in the newspaper business, we took a shot at Magnus Johnson and the Minnesota Leader. And when we met at Finco on what to do with the Minnesota leaders, A.C. Wilches' home, he was chairman of the Farmer Labor Party at that time, Magnus Johnson came out to greet the women from Finco and this judge's wife from Renville. And he had the leader, after reading about himself, on one hand he had the Minnesota leader, and on the other he was shaking hands with us. But after we got inside, maybe we didn't get Hail Columbia.
Yeah.
But the women just laughed at Magnus. Magnus had to come down to earth, but he got defeated. So you see, they had to learn the hard way. So that's a part of the program. And when I got in managing a paper that was $30,000 in debt, the raised $8,000 that I should take over if I would manage it. I said, what do I know about newspapers? Well, our high-priced editor, $200 a month and all that contest to put us away in debt. And we figured maybe you could do something with it. Maybe at least you could look after the money situation. Well, I went in there, and believe me, I had one struggling time. So, what are you going to do? Biggest paper in the county? And way in debt, no advertising. And I didn't know anything about linotype or a printer. And they said, this printer that came over from the other office, we don't know much about him. But maybe you'll have to find out a little bit about him. Well, I went along and I thought, now by running educational editorials, that the farmers will kick in, you know, and begin to help out. And that they'd renew their subscriptions. Lo and behold, after 5 weeks, I was going further in debt. And educational editorials, I'd inquire. Well, we read them. We don't hardly bother much with editorials. And besides, the editorials we had in the past didn't suit us. So one of the farmers says, why not run a comic supplement? Of all things. But this editor, or printer, he came to me one day. He says, do you know how much you're going in debt? I said, I don't know. Do you know how to measure up advertising? I don't know. Well, he said, you better learn, and begin to show me. But he also said, why don't you put in some hot stuff in there in the editorial? Hot stuff? I said, I don't know anything about hot stuff. Well, I said, you better take over. Well, he happened to be a printer in the Charters Printers Union in Minneapolis 40 or 50 years back, and kind of a roughneck in a way, that had to meet the situation. And when they wrecked some machinery and blamed it onto the printers, they'd go back, they'd wreck twice as much. So they weren't owning the printing shop, left them alone. Now they had to fight the hard way to build the printers union. So I said, you take over. Well, lo and behold, his first article he won, an editorial that climbed all over an innocent jury man next door to us, never harmed anybody. I didn't like to give the okay, but said, well, it's got to be published. He said, you want some hot stuff. Well, the next day they came and complained to me, who ordered that? This man Molly, I don't want to mention his name, he's innocent printer, jury man. Well, I said, he sold two pianos being on the school board, which is unlawful. Yeah, but that's no great crime, huh? It's unlawful. But the next week, they jumped on the editor of the other paper that made $100 by selling supplies and all that to the school, being on the school board. So that was the key, start a newspaper fight. And by the way, the farmers in the West End, they had such a fight with all these their businessmen over the nonpartisan league that they condemned the paper Renville, the one of Sacred Heart, and the one of Daniel. And they piled all these in and made a Renville County Journal. And the farmers would haul their lumber through Daniel, right through Renville, trade the other towns. So we had these people at our mercy in a way, and all the advertising we got began to come in from these places. Well, what surprised me? These Scandinavians are so roiled up over being called disloyal and all that. So after an editorial that hit the other paper, that newspaper fight, here comes people from the west end of the county, Scandinavians. And they knew that we were publishing the Renwick County Journal, so they come in. Where is that Renwick County Journal? We got to go over there and look these people over. Well, come in. Gee, that's the way they, who did that? I said, well, this fellow here, I guess you guys just thought, keep it up, that's fine. By the way, how much do I owe? Well, look at 2 years of arrears. $2, $4, $6, year ahead. And the subscriptions begin to come in. When the subscriptions come in and they begin to get 2,600 subscribers over the county, our advertising right in Olivia, a Republican town, began to come in. From then on, that went along. But along about 1924, the Minnesota Leader begins to go under. So, we being a strong organization, 14 counties, 7th ward, we got to do something about that Minnesota Leader. So it was up to me to go down to Minneapolis and see, there's the Minnesota Daily Paper then, they had the Minnesota Star then, Farmer Labor Paper. So the Star building, I went up to see about the Don Parson League enrollment, and the furniture they had, and what was left of the leader. So they say, be Gilbert, by the way. He said, well, I'm out of a job now. He says, my business is to write articles. And all he says, all I've got now is myself and this big dog here and a family, and I've got to get out. Well, I said, I'm ordered to get this stuff, haul it to Olivia. So I hired a truck and hauled it up and got up there at midnight and started the Minnesota Leader. From then on, we got in keeping the paper into existence. Well, that was a problem. But we kept it going under all circumstances till they finally got back to Minneapolis. From then on, it still prospered until the new movement came in, and that's the National Guardian. So we go on. Just like I say, it's like the Tennyson's Brook. You say you come from Poots and Con and Harn, where your river flows, the brook flows along. So you see, it's the life stream. You're going along like that brook. It goes along and will continue flowing. The same with you people. Now, if we have the situation here of the Crusaders, where they left off, I'm trying to continue, but my time is limited. But it's the young people I say that I've been trying to give these messages to. The stream of life, you've got to take over. And that's why I've emphasized quite a while now the different articles. You know, study geology. The greatest science that the big capitalists work on is geology. They go to Africa for manganese, uranium, all over the world, oil, especially oil. So the young people, I say, you've got to get the know-how so they don't have the monopoly, and you begin to get, for conservation, that you have the know-how and begin to level things off. That's your job, and I'm passing the message on. For we Crusaders leave off, you've got to continue.